This is the 8th of February, 95, on behalf of the National Council of Jewish Women, Howard Braun and Selma Weiss, interviewing Dr. Leib Kessler. We're in his very nice house on Beacon Street in his dinette. We usually have been meeting out on his sun porch. Dr. Kessler is usually standing, sort of like his, the type A personality, friendly, but type A, overlooking us, and we will continue, if you don't mind. Dr. Kessler, the last time we were here, you told us about a trip to Europe on behalf of, sponsored by, paid for by Joint, to investigate the European effect of the European Holocaust. I'd like very much for you to start there. And say one city at a time, where you were, anything you might want to say about who was there to meet you, or if there's anything exceptional about that, and then approximately how much time you spent there, and most specifically, what you saw or did at each of those sites until the end of the trip.
I want to shut it off for 1 minute.
Wait a second, will you? Say something or read the line.
To AJDC Paris. You asked me who sponsored the trip, and you said you wanted more detail about the trip than I might be prepared to give. First, let me point out that the trip was sponsored by my mother. This was a graduation present from medical school. And my choice of a present, I had that opportunity to make a choice, was this trip to Europe, which, as I pointed out, I think, in our last session, had been suggested by Kitty Falk. Mm-hmm. However, there was no money to support such activities on the part of laymen, and therefore it was necessary to be underwritten, and it was underwritten by my mother. Who is now deceased. But just to give a background on the importance of the situation, in other words, it just wasn't a willy-nilly trip of a well-to-do young man who wanted to have a stint, postgraduate stint in Europe. Let me just refer you to the letter that was written to arrange for this. And this is a letter that was written to AJDC, which means the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, Paris. Mr. Charles Malmuth, Director of Public Relations, from AJDC Europe, Harry Rosen, Director. Harry Rosen had been head of the UJF in Pittsburgh for a short period of time, and he left Pittsburgh to go to AJDC after the war. This letter regards Leib Kessler, V-I-P-I. It reads, I have written to you about the arrival of many VIPs. This is another such letter, but it falls into a somewhat different category than usual. I'm writing to you about Dr. Leib Kessler of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Leib was recently graduated from medical school and is planning to do Europe for 2 months before he goes into internship. He is sailing on the Queen Elizabeth Wednesday, April 14th, and will dock at Cherbourg and proceed directly to Paris. I am anxious that you make Leib's trip as fruitful as possible. In the first place, he is one of the most active youth leaders we have. He could have gone to Europe or elsewhere on a straight pleasure trip. Instead, he saw fit to make this junket so that he could come back to this country and be even more effective worker in a cause to which he has given all his heart and energies, the cause of helping people and helping his fellow Jews. He will be extremely valuable to the growing youth program that is developing in this country, not only JDC-wise, but even more important from a UJA viewpoint. When he comes to Paris, he will want to discuss with you an itinerary. You will find him cooperative all the way down the line. All the help you can give him will be amply repaid in terms of the good that he will be able to do in this country upon his return. An immediate problem is that of housing. And then he goes on to talk about that.
Go on. Get on to the...
Yes. I arrived in Paris. That was... my arrival date was supposed to be, I think, about April the 14th.
Close
or something,
enough.
Something thereabout. And that was in 1948.
Right.
I spent the first 2 weeks in Paris. And I left, and while in Paris, I had the opportunity to do some local sightseeing, but also was taken, at that time, there were Jewish refugees, survivors of the European Holocaust, were still in Europe, and many were in Paris. The French, who had been generally anti-Semitic, and to a large extent cooperative with the German effort, had recanted to some degree and were supportive. They opened their borders to Jewish refugees, but did not provide permanent arrangements for the Jewish refugees, but allowed them to remain there as long as they were cared for by the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee and other charitable organizations such as HIAS and other local and national charities. But it meant, in effect, that the children were kept in children's homes. There were camps, displaced persons camps, they were called, people who, adults who had no place to live or no families. And many of the refugees were from all over Europe. There was no chance, for example, for the refugees from Eastern Europe to return, no chance and no desire to return. There was a great division between Eastern Europe and Western Europe at that time. You may recall that it was in just at this time, April, I guess it was the beginning of the end of March, that the Iron Curtain, Jan Masaryk was killed, and the Iron Curtain, as Winston Churchill indicated, descended on Europe. So that it was not possible for people to go back if they wanted to without risking having been tainted by the capitalist influence of the Western part of the world. So most Jews had no desire to return, and as a result, ended up in these types of camps and hotels. It was particularly interesting at that time that Chaim Weizmann was also in Paris, and I had the opportunity to be introduced to him because he was there waiting for a call from the White House. Because there were forces in this country that were attempting to influence President Truman toward recognizing Israel or the Palestine state divided in two between Palestinians and Jews. And Truman had, up until that point, said that he wanted no parts of it. So there was a lot of activity as far as the Jewish world was concerned, and most of it centered in Paris. Surprisingly, the United States was not, Washington was not involved. As a matter of fact, Truman was out of it to this point. New York was a hub of activity, but not nearly to the extent that joint as an organization, more than UJA, more than United Palestine Appeal, really was the organization on the spot, because the major issue of the time was supplying the basic needs of survival for those who remained alive in Europe. They had no place to go back to. So it was an opportunity for these kinds of organizational meetings for me to meet with those people who were active in doing this work. It was interesting about Joint at that time that many of the people who worked for Joint had been military people, both in the English and American armies, and simply stayed on in Europe. In many instances were actually captured by the Joint hierarchy and induced to stay on in Europe because they were badly needed. For example, one of the most common types of recruitment were the quartermasters of the various military divisions. Remember that the military disbanded in Europe. There were a lot of supplies left over from the war. Tremendous supply operation, you can understand, took place. And the Joint was very clever in inducing quartermasters to join up with them and bring with them their supplies. Interestingly enough, though, we always think in terms of the hostility of military people against the Jewish people generally, there was not at this time. The support was tremendous. Generals turned their heads the other way as entire supply trains were diverted to Joint and to displaced persons camps in turn to feed the remnants of Europe. One of the interesting aspects was that there were a lot of hungry people in Europe at that time, and I became readily aware that it was the Jews that were being fed, and it suddenly became important to be Jewish if one wanted to eat. People claimed they were Jews even if they weren't. People who had never, particularly young people, never identified as Jews told me, and I visited various orphanages and camps and so forth, told me that all their lives they had avoided any identity with the Jewish people, and now they would never forget being Jewish, that they realized that that it was not within their power to forget being Jewish because Hitler made it very clear who they were. And therefore they were very happy to be identified. Most of the people that I met in Paris at that time were young people, some of whom were being prepared to ship out to Canada. Canada had agreed to accept 1,000 children. This was a special dispensation allowable in addition to the normal immigration quotas. Surprisingly, the United States, which looked good, sounded good, and which had a strong and wealthy Jewish population, was doing the least at that time. Latin American countries were helpful. Some were giving visas to a large extent, making it possible. But the bulk of the Jews were trapped in Europe, and that made about 250,000 total who survived the Holocaust.
Stay with your personal contact, action.
The most important people at Joint were very kind and took me around, showed me these things, but I have some details written up here and there, but primarily this is a general summary of what we did in Paris, went to see these various places. Then, from Paris, my itinerary took me to Geneva for just a stopover weekend, and then I was on my way to Lausanne. Now, it was interesting about the exposure in Switzerland. Switzerland had been one country where Joint was permitted to operate. And it was in Switzerland, and particularly in Lausanne, that a man who was quoted and said to have saved more lives than any man in history was a man by the name of Sally Mayer. And he operated out of Switzerland. From Switzerland, I met him, and he told me some of the adventures of what it was like to save Jews during the Holocaust.
Do you know how to spell that?
M-A-Y-E-R. First name is Sally, S-A-L-L-Y.
Okay.
I forgot to mention that the headquarters of Joint was in Paris, and the head of that was a man by the name of Joe Schwartz. Joe Schwartz, in those days, was a powerful, famous, influential man. He was, in the terms that we would consider today, a man working in social services, but this was a man who didn't mince words, who was the top of a major organization. He was in contact with presidents, kings, prime ministers, and his work in saving the remnants of the Jewish people was something monumental. I went to Milan, and I don't remember the man's name in Milan. I remember there seeing being taken to children's homes. It was interesting that one child's home, children's home, was up in the mountains, and this had been Goering's retreat, and they had made it over to a refuge for Jewish children, which was somewhat of a vendetta. I'm sure Goering rolled over in his grave. Wherever I went, and for instance, when I arrived, they had arranged for a car to pick me up. There was always a person assigned to me. I remember that I was given all kinds of introductions. The communities were poorly organized. The lay communities at that time had very little money. They depended wholly on money from either the United States Army or Joint, so that when a VIP I arrived, they laid out a red carpet. So I had the opportunity to meet the mayors of these towns and meet with them and discuss what some of the problems were. So it was a most educational, most interesting experience.
Were those people in Milan refugees from elsewhere? Were they Italian Jews?
There were some Italian Jews, but mostly they came from the north. They had come out of Austria and other countries. They collected them from all over. Some of these children had been saved by the Italian people. The Italian people were, more than any other group, cooperative and attempted to save Jews. You want to go out?
Okay, I'm not sure I want to back out of my...
In Rome, and then I went to Rome, and same type of experiences. I tried to work in some of the sites as well, but I remember I saw a Dr. Finkelstein who took me on rounds of the hospital and showed me some of the problems. I remember Dr. Finkelstein saying to me it was interesting that there was no diabetes. It was obvious that diabetes had either been cured by the Holocaust or at least wiped out by the Holocaust, but there were no diabetic Jews in his...
That's true, they probably all died.
Yeah.
What?
Didn't eat much.
They didn't eat?
They were strict diet.
That's
right.
Okay. Yeah. Whichever, we never... But chief of that division of the Rome office, a fellow I remember well by the name of Charlie Malmuth. He was a very interesting, and I was very impressed with how interesting and dynamic the people doing this work were. They were men of great integrity. They had a major role in some position in the military or in social work throughout the war. And when this organization became important, they really, like cream, rose to the top. I remember that I was in Rome on May the 14th. I think I arrived there on the 14th. And that was 1948, so that was a very significant date. My original plan had been to go to Palestine from Rome. The Haganah, which you all know is a very active
organization all over the world at that time, were in contact with me and insisted that I did not go. I can't remember the man's name who talked to me at the Rome joint office and made it clear that it would not be possible for me to offer me any protection, and I was more valuable to them in the United States than I would be in Israel. However, they did invite me as an honored guest. Point of interest that I will never forget, to attend the raising of the Israeli flag in Rome on May the 15th, 1948. That was the day that Ben-Gurion decreed the state of Israel. That was a momentous occasion to the world, but it was certainly a celebrant, we were celebrants, all of us in Rome, and had quite a time of it. It was an occasion, it was a momentous occasion. The Rome experience was wonderful for many reasons. It was wonderful because it was my first opportunity to see Italy. It was also an opportunity to really see a superb joint operation, and also to recognize the value of the Italian people, how they had really in many ways tried to protect the Jews and continued to help out. From Rome, I took a few days off and I went to Capri. Capri was a great experience. I remember why I went to Capri, because a friend of mine who had worked in Europe with Joint and had come back to the United States said that was an experience I mustn't miss. So I took a vacation and I spent 4 days in Capri. It was the most wonderful 4 days. But nonetheless, while I was in Capri, something very peculiar and special happened. I was sitting at the piazza, and with a couple of young ladies, and a man and a woman came up to me, and they said, in order for you to understand this, you have to realize that Europe was not as you know, as most people know Europe. Nobody was in Europe that wasn't there for a very important or specific reason. You couldn't get a visa, you couldn't travel, you couldn't, public transportation was not easily available. So that most people who came from America or from England had a job of some sort. Military was still in evidence everywhere. Food was difficult to come by. Black market was very strong. And I want to make a comment about that, because that was an interesting experience. But this couple came up to me and they said that they knew who I was and they had to talk to me. So I made arrangements to meet with them later, and it turned out that they were from England. And how they found out about me, like, as I say, it was Europe was one big grapevine at that time. And they said that they had a sister in Czechoslovakia who was single, and they wanted to bring her to England, and they were having difficulty communicating because the Iron Curtain had descended and one could not simply come or go from Prague. And of course we learned subsequently how serious of a problem this became. They asked me if I could arrange to get her out of Prague, and I promised that I would try. So it so happened that my orders carried me to Prague, but that was something later. But I will try to carry this on in order of how things evolved, and just mention that it was at that point that I was first introduced to this problem. This was a couple that I later became very friendly with and visited them in England. They were from Their name was Kellner, and they were from Shipley, England. But from Capri, I left for Vienna, where I met Harald Trobe. He was the head of the Viennese office. The experience there was another, I keep saying unique, monumental. Each experience was in itself somewhat memorable in the sense that it was unlikely that a young fellow like myself could ever expect to have that kind of exposure. Vienna, of course, was right in the war zone and right in the center of what had happened in Europe. And there was a saying in Europe then and still now that the Viennese made lousy soldiers but great Nazis, and the Germans made great soldiers but lousy Nazis. And so that this was really the center of anti-Semitism. A community of 165,000 Jews had been almost totally decimated. And when I was there, there were 10,000 Viennese surviving Jews out of 165,000. I was given the opportunity to tour Vienna, which was mostly in rubble. I was given the opportunity again to go to displaced persons camps, hospitals, children's orphans homes, that sort of thing, as I had been in other communities. And again, learned and saw the specific problems that faced the Jewish people at that time. I became aware, particularly in Vienna, of the activity of the Haganah and the activities of the Zionists in their attempt to train children. I actually was taken out on training missions outside of Vienna, where children were learning to farm and to do all those things that would become necessary when they left for Israel. The children were very like children. They quickly put behind them, buried their bad memories, but were able to laugh and were happy in many ways. But you could see the sadness. They were all orphans. Few families remained reasonably intact. Their hope was, the main hope that they expressed to me, that they expressed to me, was their desire to go to Palestine. It was not called Israel at that time. And they felt that Europe, there was no place for them in Europe. Europe was a bad memory. In Vienna, I was invited. I was there for about 4 or 5 days. And in Vienna, on the fourth day that I was there, I was invited to attend the first of its kind Friday night service of the Jewish people in what had been left of their major synagogue, which was bombed out. There was no roof.
Where was this?
In Vienna. And I was the guest of the head of the Jewish community, and he had a box, how do you describe that, a place of honor to be seated with his family, and the head of the joint, Harald Trobe, were his guests. We sat in the box with him, and most shocking and realization that I had, and up until this time, to know that there were 6 million Jews killed was meaningful, but it was this night that I realized how meaningful as a Jew. Because as I grew up and went to Friday night services and whenever, Saturday morning service, I always realized that I had lost my father when I was 7 years old, so it was a natural thing for me to stand up and say Kaddish. But I remember all the other children were told never to stand up, that it was a bad thing to stand up if your parents were alive. Even as a youngster, I knew there was a bunch of balderdash. I knew that was the way of things. However, that night, I realized that that practice, that superstition came to an end. Because when the rabbi sang out the El Moleh, Rachamim, every person of all ages stood as a single man to say the Kaddish. There was, for once, a realization that the Jewish people were one in this as never before. So that was a memorable experience for me. I always remember that, and I always think about that every time the Kaddish is spoken.